After struggling with alcoholism and landing in rehab, J. Martin Truce decided he was in need of an adventure. So he set out to trace Robert Louis Stevenson's voyage through the South Pacific. He writes about his travels and about his recovery from alcoholism in Headhunters at My Doorstep, which is published by Gotham Books. I'm very pleased to welcome J. Martin Truce to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Hadn't you lived in the South Pacific before you went on this journey?
I did. I spent a couple of years living in Kiribati, which is a very remote nation of atolls in the equatorial Pacific, and then subsequently moved to Vanuatu and Fiji, which is part of Melanesia.
And what had brought you there? You were born in the Netherlands, but you've lived in all sorts of different parts of the world, the Czech Republic, Canada.
That's right.
Fiji.
Exactly. But what brought me to Kiribati was just a sort of a happy accident. My girlfriend at the time, now my wife, had called me one day out of the blue when I was working as an office temp and said that she got a new job, that it would require a relocation. Would I be inclined to move to a place called Kiribati? And 2 minutes later, I quit my job, called her back and said, "Kira, what?" And that is how I sort of accidentally happened upon that island.
So if you hadn't been working as a temp, you might, if you'd had a job as a vice president of a corporation, none of this would have happened. But the alcoholism might have. Were you already struggling with alcoholism at that time?
No. I think my story is fairly typical. For a good 20 years or so, I thought that I was firmly in control. I never drank before five, never did anything but beer or wine or something like that. But with time, I gradually lost any sense of control.
And what were you doing to make a living?
I've been a writer for the past 10 years. Previous to that, so living the cliche.
And then you decide to go into rehab. We got that extreme.
Yeah, I did. Some of us need to take 28 days to really focus on this.
Now, a lot of people get out of rehab. They struggle to remain sober, but very few of them decide to trace the same route as Robert Louis Stevenson did after they get out.
Yes, it's a benign form of escapism, I thought. You know, escapism is on a spectrum with travel and watching Game of Thrones on one end and shooting heroin on the other end. So,
but Stevenson, not one of the, I mean, he's a very popular writer. He wrote Treasure Island, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I wonder if you see alcoholics as having some similarity to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's an analogy that works very well. There's sort of the dark side that gives into the substance, and there's the other side that is repelled, that you're actually feeling the need to do this.
Had you read him?
I'd read in the past. I'd read things like Treasure Island and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but it was when I really started reading his literature from the South Seas that I became intrigued in him, not just in his work but in his life.
He had he grew up in Scotland, but then he came to the United States first, didn't he?
He did. He was a vagabond really for his almost his entire adult life. He moved first down to London and other parts of England, and then onwards to France, to Switzerland, and then to the United States, the Adirondacks, and to California, and all of it was sort of a quest for his good health.
Well, what inspired Treasure Island, which is very different from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
I think what Treasure Island is, that was written truly as a boy's yarn, as a children's yarn. And it was soon after he married his wife, Fanny, who was 10 years older than he and had was a divorcee with children of her own. And I think it was a sudden inclusion of children in his life that compelled him to write this wonderful, you know, galloping yarn.
Wasn't it Sam McClure, the publisher of the New York Herald Tribune, who came up with the idea for him to sail to the South Pacific? Why there? I mean, I understand go west, young man, but go South Pacific, young man?
Well, at the time when he approached Stevenson, they were living up in upstate New York, having just sort of in the midst of a terrible winter where everything was frozen. They were bitterly cold. So the whole idea of traipsing around the South Pacific must have been particularly compelling at the time. But
it wasn't seen as dangerous?
It was, but that's the interesting nature of Robert Louis Stevenson. I mean, when he finally left California to sail the South Seas, when he stood on board the Casco, he stood approximately 5'10" and weighed all of 95 pounds. He was a very ill man. He was always gaunt. And yet sort of he traveled really, he fell off the map and traveled around the world or around to really difficult places. And I think that sort of speaks to his nature. Some say that, or he himself would say that he traveled for his health, but then he would also say, I travel for travel's sake.
And he went first to the Marquesas from San Francisco. Did he wind up fulfilling his part of the deal with Sam McClure?
No, what he had a grand ambition to sort of write the ultimate book about the South Pacific. He wanted to write about the ethnography, he wanted to write about the landscape, he wanted to write about the history and the culture, and of course his readers at the time really wanted to read about Stevenson's experiences.
You also write about a childhood hero, Thor Heyerdahl. Mm-hmm. I guess he was a childhood hero for many of us.
Yes.
I remember Kon-Tiki.
Yes.
Had you been interested in going to the South Pacific after you heard about his journey?
Absolutely.
So when your girlfriend called, were you thinking, oh, Thor Heyerdahl?
Well, that's part of sort of the fabulous mythology of the South Pacific. And Thor Heyerdahl is certainly a part of that, too.
When did Westerners first start visiting the South Seas?
It would be roughly in the 18th century is when they started coming by some numbers, particularly with Captain Cook and Krusenstern and the Frenchman de Bougainville.
And certain islands got certain nationalities. Hawaii obviously got people from this country, many of them from New England.
Mm-hmm.
But the French wound up in Tahiti. Is that why Gauguin went there?
Well, Gauguin was perpetually a wanderer. I mean, he moved first from France, then he was up in Scandinavia, then back to France, then onward to Martinique, and he was a man that was running from his demons for the entirety of his life. Tahiti was too much for him, and then he ran off to the Marquesas, where he
Hivaoa.
Yes.
Where also the Belgian singer Jacques Brel
That's right.
Settled for a while. Jacques Brel is not alive and well. In fact, he's buried in Hivaoa, isn't he?
It's true. So this tiny little island has two celebrities buried there, though we can't be certain that Gauguin is actually buried there.
But Gauguin went there to paint. He wanted to go native. What about Jacques Brel? Why was he there?
He had a diagnosis of lung cancer. And then he took it upon himself that instead of staying close to his home in France or in Belgium, he decided to take a catch and sail it around the world. And when he came to Hivaoa, he found it such an agreeable spot. He decided to stay. When he first arrived, he met some boys there. He was quite famous in Europe. And they were playing some music. And he said, well, do you mind if I take that guitar and sing a song? And he sang in his lugubrious voice, and the boy said, ah, this is terrible. You don't know how to sing. Leave it to us. And he found the response so agreeable that he decided to stay, because here he could be anonymous.
Now, when Westerners first started going to the South Seas, do we have a lot of literature of what their impressions were and what the impressions of the indigenous people were of them?
There were, particularly the literature that came out of visits to what is now French Polynesia. When you read de Bougainville and also Captain Cook, I think what people were really struck by the different sort of cultural, social norms than what they were accustomed to in cold northern Europe. And sort of a romance and mythology really was born out of that.
Well, was the romance for you that, or following Robert Louis Stevenson's, tracing his steps?
It was the following the Robert Louis Stevenson. I found him a deeper writer than most that had been written about at the time. And islands, because I spent so much of my formative years, remain very, very special places for me.
Did you see this trip as a test for your sobriety?
The whole world can be sort of a test for sobriety, so I try not to sort of focus on the travel or on the geography.
Well, is it difficult to be on a boat in the open sea when you're craving a drink?
That wasn't fun, but that's just the reality of things. From time to time, the craving pops up, and you just have to handle it accordingly.
What did you do to remain sober?
For me, one of the big things that I took was running and exercise. And there was a gym on board where I pounded the treadmill as we heaved over waves. There's nothing like running on a treadmill in an 8-foot swell.
Well, you don't have to put an incline into the thing. You just have to worry about speed.
Exactly.
You mentioned a number of addiction memoirs. Do you have any favorites?
There's a lot that I like. I like Lit by Mary Carr. I think that's a wonderful book. I think Drinking a Love Story by Carolyn Knapp is a wonderful read. There's quite some good literature these days.
Did they help you navigate through your sobriety?
What it does is sort of it normalizes the fact that you have this condition. There's nothing unusual. There's nothing special about me. It's a condition that millions upon millions upon millions of people deal with.
Well, this book is really about travel.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you even include the addiction aspect?
Well, all of my books have been sort of memoirs, travel memoirs to one degree or another, and this happened to be part of my life. But the other thing that I wanted to do is sort of contribute my part to sort of taking the stigma and the shame away from it. Really, I mean, you have a brain condition. It is what it is. And I don't think it's that much different than diabetes, really, and we should be able to talk freely about it.
Well, how much has the South Pacific been changed by the influx of Western culture? I remember many years ago knowing a sailor who had worked as a merchant seaman in the South Pacific, and he said he was also a photographer. He went to Tahiti. He saw this woman who reminded him of somebody from a Gauguin painting. He said, "Can I take your picture?" She said, "If I take off my blouse, it's going to cost you 100 francs."
Yeah, that sounds about right. That's for Tahiti. And that's very true of Tahiti. Tahiti it's literally France. When you are in Tahiti, you are truly in France. Being so familiar with the rest of the South Pacific, it was very strange being in this place. But other parts of the South Pacific are much more truer to their nature, and they deal with things. They have far different issues.
Are there still missionary schools in the islands?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, particularly the Mormons these days. You know, the Pacific Islanders don't wear much, but you'd be surprised how many are wearing magic underwear.
Uh-huh. So that's because the other missionaries didn't have much of an impact?
No, they did.
They just had a crisis of faith.
It's typically an island became Catholic or Protestant, depending on which missionary group arrived first. But these days, there's more missionaries competing, so to speak.
Many tourists head to Tahiti, Fiji, Hawaii. Is there much of a tourist industry in the Marquesas and the other islands that you visited?
Marquesas, the more interesting islands, are only accessible by boat. So it's at least a 3-4 day journey from Tahiti. So there's not as many there. And then in Kiribati, there are no tourists whatsoever.
We have to talk about the title, The Headhunters, Headhunters on My Doorstep.
Yes.
You didn't encounter headhunters, but Robert Louis Stevenson did?
Yes. So I'm pleased to say, you know, my first book was called The Sex Lives of Cannibals, and then the next one was called Getting Stoned with Savages, and those are my own creation. But The Headhunters on my Doorstep comes from a letter that Stevenson wrote that he used to describe sort of his neighborhood in Samoa, where he ultimately settled.
Well, we think of the South Pacific as being a place of island paradises, Tahiti, where Freud wrote about in Civilization and Its Discontents, mm-hmm. No need for civilization because everybody just lives such a happy life. But there were headhunters in parts of these islands. Didn't one local woman show you an ancient cannibal village?
Yes, but I find it very interesting about the headhunting reference because particularly in Samoa, because headhunting was unknown to Samoa before the missionaries arrived. And it was only after they learned about the story of John the Baptist that they took up headhunting as a form of violence. So it was the missionaries that brought in headhunting.
You got a tattoo?
I did. I think I am perhaps the only person on this planet who waited until he was over the age of 40, completely sober, to get a first tattoo.
And you got it there, not in Brooklyn.
No.
Do you regret it at all?
No, I don't. It's a little crooked, but as I always say, I'm a little crooked myself, so it's a good fit.
You went back to Kiribati?
I did go back to Kiribati.
Now, had it changed much since you had lived there the first time?
It was striking, and there was many ways in which it hadn't changed at all, but the most glaring difference was at high tide, and then you really notice that the country is sinking.
Because of global warming, even though Tom Coburn says he's proud to be a denier?
Yeah, well, what can you do with these people? But
you're in Washington these days. I was wondering if you're living among a different kind of savage.
Right, exactly. But it's being on the islands. When I lived there in the late 90s, we didn't really worry about being washed off. But an atoll is only 2 feet above sea level. And now when you go there, you see the coconut trees on the shoreline. They're all dead. People that tried to grow gardens nearby, all gone, all dead. And the people themselves are making plans to move.
Where are they going to go to, another island?
They just bought land in Vanuatu in Fiji, where they're currently growing their food needs, and that's probably where they'll settle. So we're going to lose an entire country here.
Because we saw a similar situation with during nuclear tests where people were forced to leave their home islands, but they eventually wanted to move back to the Bikini Atoll.
That's right. Pacific Islanders are, as you can imagine, are very, very attached to their islands.
They won't be able to do it if these islands just disappear.
No, there'll be an octopus living in their home.
Jay Martin Troost, T-R-O-O-S-T, is the author of three travel memoirs, and his essays have appeared in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, Islands, and The Prague Post. His latest book is called Headhunters on My Doorstep, A True Treasure Island Ghost Story. It is published by Gotham Books. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.